Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to episode number 12 of the Free Cities Podcast. Now, this is the second iteration of my series of conversations recorded in Prague, and today I'm talking to a gentleman by the name of Jozef Tetek. Jozef is an author, educator, and founder of the Slovak Ludwig von Mises Institute. He also hosts the popular Czech podcast Stakuj, which is a show about Bitcoin, money, and freedom. Now, Jozef's background in Austrian economics and political philosophy informs the majority of our conversation, and we start off by having an interesting discussion about the private provision of public goods and the various incarnations of this model that have existed around the world. Jozef makes particular reference to BB Centrum, which is a privately owned public neighborhood not far from where we were recording the podcast in Prague. Other topics discussed include social engineering, the evolution and dissolution of the state, digital gulags, and Jozef reports on what he discovered about monetary colonialism during a recent trip to the African Bitcoin Conference in Ghana. This was another extremely fascinating conversation from the Czech Republic. Look out for more of them on this show over the next few weeks. And if you're enjoying our content, please leave us a review on your podcasting app. And thank you in advance. In the meantime, just leaves for me to say, please sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Jozef Tetek. Time I come to Prague, I find out about all these things that are going on because it's all in Czech. Mm-hmm. No one else, like none of us, get to privy to any of these things, and that's what I love about this place. You know, there's a massive scene here, and I didn't realize as well. Correct me if I'm wrong, but what I'm discovering is there's quite a big freedom scene here. Is that fair to say? If you look at Europe or in general, or Eastern Europe or whatever, is it quite a strong scene here?
Yeah, I don't really have a comparison across all the countries. That's sort of a problem with Bitcoiners and libertarians in Europe. We are very fragmented, and usually we don't know what's going on in Italy or France or Spain because we don't speak the language. But as for Czech Republic, like the Austrian school and libertarianism, this is very strong and has been very strong here since the 90s for multiple reasons, like all the books from Friedman, Mises, Hayek were translated very early on and distributed through proper channels. A lot of the discussions in the mainstream media was like revolving around libertarianism. And our one of the second president, in fact, of the Czech Republic when Czechoslovakia split. So the second president after Václav Havel, that was Václav Klaus, and he was quite libertarian, or let's say classical liberal. He always loved Friedman. So we have quite a strong foundation of like libertarianism and anarcho-capitalism as well. And
is that a symptom of the history of the Czech Republic, or according to you?
Partially, yeah, partially, definitely. People had strong animosity against socialism in the 90s. So 90s was a sort of the free era. And these thoughts were very interesting to people, like Austrian school and Chicago School of Economics and the whole like sound economics discipline. And of course, the political philosophy that comes along with it, libertarianism. And I don't think, for example, in Slovakia, it's as strong as in Czech Republic. Maybe we had a better luck on the individuals. For example, my my tutor of my master's thesis, he was very active in political philosophy activism. We had a libertarian institute founded in 1989, and he was very active in that, and he translated all the books from Rothbard and Mises and Hayek, and he had a good standing with the University of Economics, where he headed one department, and he was very influential. So we had a good luck on people like that were able to get into influential positions and spread libertarianism and Austrian School of Economics for the past 30 years. It's not as strong now as it used to be, but still, maybe it's not as strong now in universities, but it is in blogs, think tanks, YouTube, and stuff like that. Yeah.
Would you say that when the sort of socialist system broke down, the void, people were looking to replace that void with something? And at that point, I mean, how old are you? I take it you weren't around.
I'm 38.
So what did you experience of that era?
Yeah, I was 4 years old when the Iron Curtain fell, so I don't remember that.
I'm interested to work out is, because Austrian economics was something that I didn't hear about until I was well into my 40s, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah,
which is unusual when you think about it, because economics is an important subject. I studied economics at what we call A-level, which isn't a high level, but I did study it. And no one mentioned anything about Austrian economics. So what I'm wondering is, in the case of the Czech Republic, when everything broke down and people were obviously asking questions like, what is a good system? And why was it that Austrian economics was offered up and not Keynesianism or the route that I came? How come Austrian economics slipped in there? And did it outcompete the other theories, let's say?
Yeah, I don't know if I have the real answers here, but the Liberalny Institute that was founded in 1999, and the economists during the 80s were already sort of aware of Hayek and Mises and all the greats, and they were eager to publish these books that they basically translated into their night table and weren't able to publish it before. So very early on in the early 90s, these books were published. And since these were academics, they had a good standing with the universities. They were free to express their thoughts. And I don't know, we are just lucky to have a couple of high-quality individuals that knew how to steer the country in the right way. Of course, a lot of stuff that's criticized now happened in the 90s, a lot of stuff was privatized. A lot of people hate that until today. But the books of all the greats in Austrian economics and libertarianism were published early on, and then these people and their students started to publish works of their own, and it sort of lived on from then. As I say, now it's no longer as strong. The University of Economics that was for some time quite full of Austrian economists got sort of purged for some internal reasons. And the legacy is here. The tradition of Austrian school is here, definitely.
And you say it's taught in universities?
It was when I studied, around 2010. I had a good luck on studying the Faculty of Economic Policy at the University of Economics. And we had a compulsory reading of Murray Rothbard and Mises and Bastiat, and very great discussions about Mark Thornton's take on prohibition. And we read articles from the American Mises Institute all the time and discussed them. And so my university studies were a perfect real like Austrian school education, which isn't the case for most people. So it's kind of funny for me when you say you discovered it in your 40s, because for me it was just part of my university studies. But I aimed to go to that faculty because I knew this was going on in there, and it was sort of special in Czech Republic as well. So I wanted to have this type of education, and then I wrote my master's thesis on private provision of public goods, because that was what was really exciting about for me, that everybody was saying like you cannot have like private sidewalks, private parks, and there's so much literature about this happening throughout history, mostly in the United States, but also in Europe, like the private toll roads. And of course, Ronald Coase's example with lighthouses, where he disputed Samuelson, that was always beautiful to me.
Sorry, with what? Which one?
With lighthouses, like the private lighthouses in England, in medieval England, I think it was. Because Paul Samuelson always gave, like a typical example of public good is a lighthouse, according to Paul Samuelson. And Ronald Coase sort of doubted that, and he actually went and looked through the evidence and found out that in England, and I'm not sure about the period, it probably wasn't the medieval times, it was later on, but he found out that lighthouses were actually provided privately.
And what, the shipping companies paid a...
Yeah, you paid the fee in the port, like part of like the package of services, and you paid for the lighthouses as well. And that's actually a brilliant example of how like the so-called public goods can be bundled with services you are already consuming or you want to consume, and you can have these public goods privately provisioned. A good example is park or sidewalks or public lightning or street lightning, because for example in Prague there is this let's say a private zone at Brumovka BB Centrum, and you couldn't tell, like when you are in that place, you cannot tell it's all privately owned because it's free to enter, nobody takes any fees, but the way it's structured is there are residential housings, there are office complexes, and the rent is sufficiently high, and the surrounding environment is of a high quality, so the renters are willing to pay the higher rent. So you just bundle the so-called public goods with the private ones, with the need to pay for the housing or the office space. And yeah, that's how you do it. The same is in New York. There's also Bryant Park. I'm not sure how it's structured actually, but Bryant Park is also privately provisioned. That's quite a famous example.
That's interesting, because intuitively you would put a fence around that place.
Yeah.
So why is that? Why is there no fence around it? Like, I get the idea that it's affordable. But why wouldn't you put a fence around it? I mean, you would have imagined the people that are paying would intuitively think, okay, well, let's make sure that no one, you know, devalues our investment here.
Yeah, that can also be the case. And it is in case of gated communities. These are normal around the world. And even in Prague, we have quite a large one. And within this gated community in Prague, there is a huge park that's beautiful, and I went there for my master's thesis. And but if you have like a neighborhood with shops and office buildings, you don't want to restrict the access. It doesn't make sense. And what makes sense then is to have this public area that is privately controlled and increases the rent, increases the land value, and you just gather like the payments for that in this bundled way where the rent is higher simply. And
do you happen to know if that's a common experience around the world? Privately owned public places?
Yeah, I would like to take a look into that after more than 10 years since I wrote this paper. Because I researched that for a year back then, but that was in 2011. And yeah, I discovered communities like that in Europe, in the United States, of course, in South Africa. That's quite famous for them. That's mostly these gated communities, and throughout history. One well-known example is St. Louis neighborhoods, where the whole neighborhoods in St. Louis were privately owned and everything was privately provisioned. There's also a city in the United States, I probably forgot the name, that was built by Walt Disney Company. Mm. And it's not like a Disneyland. It's a normal, like a small town American city.
I know.
You know that one?
White wooden buildings.
Yeah. And it's very strict about like what you can do in there.
Yes.
Yeah. So what I discovered when I researched that was there was a whole range of arrangements. Some of it is really strict, really gated communities. Some of them are more like communes. But all of these communities, like in some way, try to provision public goods without the state, without any intervention. And if there is, like, let's say in this city built by Walt Disney, everything is strict, but you sign the contract and you know upfront what are your rights and what you have to do. Like you cannot build anything else than a white picket fence, for example. I remember that.
I do, and, too, yes.
And in some other places, I forget all the names, so sorry for that, but there's one other place in the US which is more like a hippie community, but has been around for quite a long time. And it's not as strict, but it simply works. But that's a small community. So, of course, that wouldn't work maybe with larger cities. But there are a lot of examples from the 19th century America where a lot of neighborhoods were basically privately owned and privately managed, and it worked, and it was it worked very well. Or there were like company cities which worked as well. So throughout history, and even now, we have a lot of examples. And as I say, it's a spectrum. Like there is no. Like one meme that would be true about private provision of public good. There are usually no fees for entry to a private park. Usually it's that would be like the dumbest way how to organize that. Usually it's in some way bundled and so it's a very interesting.
Do you have a preferred favorite method? You said it's a spectrum. I agree. And what's lovely about a spectrum is you get to choose the one you want. What's your preferred way?
Yeah, so probably the BB Centrum in Prague, where you cannot really tell you are in a libertarian neighborhood. it's not, of course, libertarian, but the guy who owns it, it's a privately owned company. Like only, I believe, one person or maybe two person own that company, and they are like billionaires, and he's very religious, which is quite uncommon for Czechs, and he has this belief that he needs to like create good communities, like good neighborhoods, but he does it in an entrepreneurial way. So he first built like the office complexes, which were of very high quality, attracted good tenants that were willing to pay high rents. Then he built the park, then the residential housing, he built a church, all the sidewalks, all the streetlights are owned by the company. He basically owns all the land in there. And yeah, it's very clean, very nice. It doesn't get closed for night or anything, like the park and the sidewalks. So that's my preferred version, probably.
That's fascinating, because you're basically describing the free city model in yeah. a way, you know. And even Prospero, which is in Honduras, which is a you know, probably one of the most advanced versions that are in existence, have started in exactly the way you described. the beta building was with one of the first building, which was businesses. Mm-hmm. As soon as they came, then they needed accommodation, which is now being built. And that's so. A question about that place you were describing: was it barren land? Did he really build it from the bottom up, or was it?
I'm not really certain. Maybe some of it was brownfields, and some of it were maybe like old factories. There were, in the early 90s, there were a lot of like abandoned factories and abandoned houses and brownfields around Prague. And it changed quite a lot over the past 30 years. So it's not in the city center, but it's not on the outskirts as well. So I don't think it was totally empty before, but I believe it was just a lot of underutilized land, and he basically bought it up gradually and turned it into this neighborhood.
In your in your sort of framework of belief, could a system evolve that was a myriad of small decentralized neighborhoods like that? Is that something that you've ever thought about, or whether you think is a good or a bad model? Or
I believe it's a natural tendency. If the state, like either local or national, were to in some way step away, this is mostly what would happen, that the land in the cities is very valuable, usually, if the city isn't like too bad, which Prague definitely isn't. So it would be bought up and it would be used for the most valuable use, which nowadays in like Western cities is office complexes, parking, parks, residential building. And like contrary to what people may think, the parks and the sidewalks and the public spaces, the squares will be there, because this is what increases the value of the rent and of the land. So for economists, this is quite obvious. But for a lot of people that misunderstand libertarianism, they believe like it's some kind of dystopia where there will be only just some skyscrapers and parking fields and malls. But that's not the case. And yeah, actually, one of the authors that covers this topic of private provision of public goods gives an example of, for example, a mall, that in the mall you actually have a lot of non-commercial spaces, like you have benches, you have fountains, you have like these public spaces, and it's I forgot the name of the author, but he says it's like a mini universe of the city, and you can actually see how the city in the large scale would sort of be organized if it was privately owned. And you can see that it's not some hellish dystopia full of concrete, but it can actually be a nice place. And like the high quality malls usually are quite a nice places.
I'm not so sure I have that much faith in scaling, though, a model like that. I agree that the fountains in a mall are looked after nicely, but a lot of things don't scale very well. Mm-hmm. And I'm not convinced that it would scale to the city level potentially. I think most things have a sweet spot where they work really well, and the same goes for most ideologies, most ideas, most
right. It will depend on like the certainty of property rights, because the more certain you are of your property rights and that any investments you put into the land and what you build on it, that you can really accrue all the value from that, the more long-term planning you will probably be. It all basically comes down to property rights, like everything in economics does. And you are rightly skeptical, because in the current environment, it maybe wouldn't work that well, because the property rights aren't that certain. Like, I don't know where they are actually certain, like definitely not in Czech Republic, and we are not the worst state as such. There are much worse places around the world. But this is one of the arguments that Hernando de Soto makes about why the developing countries are in such a bad shape. And usually it's because you don't have this certainty in terms of property rights, and you cannot use the capital that you own, which for poor people is usually just the land, if they are farmers, and you cannot take a mortgage on it. You cannot use it as a collateral because the property rights aren't actually recorded anywhere, and then you cannot build any sort of capitalism around that.
Did you, in your work or research or anything, did you go much into the best system for preserving property rights? Is that something that you've thought about much?
Well, that's... I didn't in this particular paper, but Bruno Leoni, the Italian law theorist who influenced Friedrich Hayek quite a lot, he went into the English common law and the German, the term for that, but sort of like a common law which worked in German lands for hundreds of years. And basically the best way how to ensure the rule of law is decentralized courts that are very independent from the state, from the ruler. No legislation. The laws are usually the result of the emergent process. This is where Hayek was very influenced by that line of thought. And it's an emergent system, sort of like money, sort of like language, and the idea that we can just plan this top down with some couple of hundred guys in fancy buildings calling themselves legislators and just like centrally plan how this will all be organized is very very naive, and it obviously doesn't work. So we cannot have a strong rule of law and strong property rights in the current system. This is stacked against that, and it's a tough question to say how we could actually get back to like the common law system or what we had had here before, like 18th, 19th century, when the legislative process really took off. But legal theory is not my strong, my strong discipline. I just know Bruno Leoni and Friedrich Hayek, and I love their line of thought.
You, talking of the state, you've written a couple of books, right? Is that right?
Yeah, two.
Yeah, I love the title of one of your books. is a brilliant title, "Enemies of the State, Friends of Liberty." Right.
Right.
That's a really, I love that statement. So I get that you're not necessarily a fan of the state.
No.
so tell me where you see the role of the state then. Is it in a way that I will have heard before, or do you have any sort of like unusual ideas about it?
I don't think it's unusual. I was very influenced by Murray Rothbard, so I am flavor of anarchism, and but I used to be very passionate about it and tried to like convince everybody the state sucks and we need like to convince everyone about libertarianism, and I discovered this doesn't work actually,
as a few other people have, I'm sure.
So yeah, I'm more practical about it. Like I am very well aware that the state isn't going anywhere in our lifetimes. It will be a gradual process where the state will become more and more irrelevant. This is how I would like to for things to evolve. In terms of what is the proper role of state, I don't think ultimately there is any, but in the short term, it's hard to say. Like, if I say police and judicial system, there are so many examples of this being so wrong today. Even like in Czech Republic, which is very liberal towards soft drug use, you still see people being thrown in prison for growing their weed and doing the ayahuasca rituals.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, usually you have this idea that the police just catches the bad guys, but there is so much collateral damage from that. On the other hand, if we pressed like the Rothbard's red button and the state is gone right now, it would be such a chaotic era. And we sort of saw where that can lead in 90s Russia, where the mafia or the gangs took over. So yeah, that's a tough one. So the problem is we used to have like everything in place until like 18th, 19th century with the decentralized courts, with sound money, with decentralized education. There was no state education back then. And the society evolved very quickly. It was the arts, the industry, everything evolved very quickly, and we sort of lost that line, and now we may be at the end of like this experiment, and it's going to get very chaotic. But after that, I believe things are going to get much better.
So, can you categorize that a bit? What this experiment is? I think I know what you mean, but I'd like to hear your words. You know, what is the experiment that's coming to an end?
Right. So in two words, it's just social engineering. It's this idea, this naive rationalism that you can just manage the society in all its aspects, whether it's money and financial system, whether it's the state provision of public goods, justice, policing, education, diet. And it permeates everything, and gradually in individual fields we are rediscovering that this might not be the best approach. I know that, for example, in the United States, homeschooling is getting quite popular. It's getting quite popular in Czech Republic as well. Alternative approaches to diet. I'm a big proponent of the carnivore diet or the animal-based diet. And money, like this is my main topic. Like Bitcoin fixes this.
Sure. Before we get onto that, would society always tend towards that? That, you know, like if this gets fixed, is it inherent that we tend back towards this kind of centralization of the decision-making process?
Yeah, that's a very good question and good thing we need to be aware of, that people are always lured in to power. And yeah, like all the philosophers throughout all the history are aware of that. So yeah, the lure of power will be always here. And I don't believe people will just accept libertarian thought and just get on with each other. That's a tough question that all the political philosophers were discussing about for hundreds of years or thousands.
Do you have a theory? You said earlier that the state will just dissolve into irrelevance. You said.
Yeah.
So describe how that happens then, because I don't think the state thinks that's going to happen.
Yeah. Right. I believe Franz Oppenheimer, the German sociologist, he has a very good theory of how the state emerged and how then it evolved in the way it did. And it had its own logic that was very hard to overcome back then, tens of thousands of years before, because he describes, I don't know if you are familiar with his works, but maybe I can describe it anyway.
Describe it, please.
So Franz Oppenheimer basically says that you had, tens of thousands of years before, you had, the farmers that needed to stay in one place and cultivate the land, and they needed to be kept safe. And then you had, the nomadic hunters that were basically attacking the farmers all the time. So the farmers, and the nomadic hunters that were exploiting them, discovered after some time that it's best not to kill the goose and to basically turn them into slaves and to protect them against other nomadic tribes. And this is how, according to Oppenheimer, the state emerged. And it has its own logic. It was basically it was an exploitative relationship, but it made sense at the time, and it was basically mutually beneficial. And then it evolved from that, where the state was always like this partially protective, partially exploitative force that was attached to like the productive sector. And I believe the technology changes this equation, where gradually the productive elements of the society do not need this protection from the force by the slave masters, by the exploiters, by the political class. I believe money is a big part of that, because the state always needed a monopoly of money, because this is how you exploit the society in the most elegant way, without bashing anybody over the head. And yeah, if we separate the money from the state, it's going to get much harder for the state to keep as much power as it has now.
I could agree with that. I like that analogy. It does seem to be that way. So what I would take away from that is that currently the state is in the process of trying to. You said that forces at the moment are destabilizing the state, would you say?
Yeah.
What is that, technology?
Yeah, it's mostly technology. And in my book about Bitcoin, I have an example of the media, where first, like, let's say 200 years ago, it was much easier for the state to control the media if it wanted to, because some messengers reading the decrees in the public square, then it was newspapers and printed books, and this is very easy to control if you want to. Then there emerged radios and televisions, still very much centralized, very easy to control, and the socialist states all knew that, the Nazis knew that, and used these new forms of communication for propaganda. And during our communist times, all the television, all the radio, all the newspapers, all the book printing was in some way managed by the state and always connected to some state propaganda. But with the internet, this was sort of turned on its head. I know there are a lot of like examples of censorship, and the state is still sort of trying to keep control. But if you have the ability to tweet, to run your own YouTube channel, and it doesn't have to be YouTube anymore right now. Nowadays there are other alternatives emerging. And I don't think anybody can dispute that the internet opened up the discussion to like really decentralize the discussion, and a lot of voices that wouldn't have any way to express themselves now have it. A really fringe example is Alex Jones. Like, whatever you think of him, he would never be invited to any public television in the 70s, let's say. But with the internet, he had his own channel, and he's very influential. And right, so the media is probably the best example in that. But education as well. Like, you can access all the courses of American universities now. We have Coursera, Udemy, you have all these platforms. You can learn from YouTubers. You can buy books on Amazon for the Kindle books, or you can download these. So the access to education is also quite decentralized, and people are just waking up to the fact that the public schooling doesn't really provide you with education anymore, or I don't know if it ever did. So the media, the education, great examples, and I believe technology is basically a very liberating instrument.
Okay, so I'm going to have to push back on that, because two reasons. One is, I agree with you that the internet opened up many things. But currently, you could argue most people experience the internet through four oligarchical companies, which are no better or worse than the state. In fact, they may even be the new state that's emerged. So that's my first my first question. My second one will be that I think, obviously, there's a very compelling argument that technology is actually empowering the state. And a good example of that would be CBDCs, central bank digital currencies, and the technology of, say, a social credit score system, which will be scaling authoritarianism. Prior to that, I mean, if you look at somewhere like Russia, you know, you try to scale authoritarianism and in the end it collapsed under its own weight. Okay, but now, you know, technology allows authoritarianism to scale. For example, with the social credit score system, it's a self-perpetuating system. It doesn't need a bureaucracy to run it. It's run by algorithms. And it's just as powerful as, you know, an oligarch sitting in a castle controlling his surrounding area. So so there are my two things. So what's your answer to that? One, that technology does actually empower the state, and two, that the internet is already an example of how it's been co-opted by large, powerful organizations.
Yeah. I'll address the second one first. So the internet in its current form is here maybe for like 20 years. And already throughout these 20 years, we have seen the platforms emerge and fall. There are many examples, like MySpace is the usual one, or ICQ. So depends on how these companies will be able to build a moat around them, like the regulatory moat. That would be the real danger. Because as it is now, still to some way, in some way, the newcomers still can disrupt the sector. Already we see that, like Facebook, it's a real huge money-making machine, but the young people aren't setting up accounts on Facebook. They are either on Twitter or TikTok, which TikTok is horrible, of course. But the thing is, it's not a monopoly. There are like so many alternatives emerging all the time, and I don't believe Facebook will be as powerful 10 or 20 years from now, because people will basically not care anymore about it. So it's a very short period so far for the internet. And I believe throughout this period of like 20, 25 years, it has proven that it is like nobody has a real like monopoly on it. And we can see it even with Twitter. It's losing money at a horrible pace. And a lot of the scale that was built over the past 10 years is also due to easy money policies, because these corporations were able to finance themselves through very low interest rates, and they took the advantage of that. So we will see how it goes in the 20s, which doesn't seem to be the low interest rate era. I think this decade will be quite different. So, and the second one was if the state can misuse these tools for their own gain. And of course, the state always tries to use technology like that. But I believe digital technologies are much more accessible to normal, to like ordinary people, which wasn't the case with like machinery or television channels, like military machinery, I mean. With digital technology, it's very hard to keep it in check. Even in China, where the Bitcoin mining was banned, there are still a lot of Bitcoin miners. Bitcoin is still used. And one thing is like Chinese propaganda and what you like hear about. And of course, it seems like the state has everything under control. The other thing is, it's simply over 1 billion people, and people will always find a way how to communicate, exchange value, exchange goods and services. And I believe ultimately digital technologies are liberating technologies. But of course, we need to be vigilant, and we need to use like the proper tools. I would rather use Signal, an encrypted peer-to-peer messenger, over like the Facebook Messenger, because this is not safe, right? So there is definitely some level of education for people to attain. But it's much more accessible. That's how I would sum it up. And when some technology is accessible and provides like some real benefits to people, people will adopt it sooner or later.
Will they though? Without pushing back again, are you sure that history has taught us that people will push back? That's the thing. I mean, my own particular view of this is that all the authoritarianisms up until this point have been part of the game, and now it's the final boss, because the final boss is the authoritarianism that can scale indefinitely, which I think it was always limited by physical factors before, or you couldn't get the bureaucracy big enough, you couldn't get enough people to join the state to enforce it. But with algorithms, you can, and it actually take, you could be one guy sitting up in an ivory tower and you could control a billion people with algorithms, because they're already invested in it. And it's obviously a very compelling network of digital, you know, a digital sort of structure that keeps you in place. And it's very obvious to me that it's happening, because we're already kind of doing it. We're already voluntarily joining it. And like I say, going back to my two points, currently most people are interacting into the digital world through one of four platforms, pretty much. And if you think that they have your best interest at heart, I don't know who does, but you can't. They're no better or worse than large states, large countries. So there's that. And the fact that that they can now scale indefinitely at the touch of a button, they don't need a bureaucracy. They don't need millions of people enforcing. They're enforcing it through currently a box that you carry in your pocket with a digital screen on it. And who knows what that'll be one day.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I don't want to sound too naive about it. There are real dangers, like we've seen in Canada with the Freedom Convoy. You can be easily cut off from all the financial platforms if you misbehave. In some part, people need to pay attention, which is maybe too optimistic for the majority of the society. But I don't believe you can construct like a digital gulag without, because if you do that, I don't think, like, for example, the Chinese system is very stable. I believe in at some point the Chinese government will basically collapse under its own weight, and it boils down to economics. Because there is this impression that China is like the huge economic power, but as we've seen last year with Evergrande and the whole like real estate market basically collapsing and needed to be bailed out, the structure of Chinese economy is in very bad shape, and they really cannot afford any large recession. And like, this is basically the deal, that you can partially control the society through these tools, as you describe, but you need to provide something in exchange, like a gradually increasing life standards, which has been the case in China for the past 30 years. But if the second part of the equation doesn't work anymore, if the life standards don't increase anymore because of the socialistic planning basically hits the dead end, then I believe the surveillance won't work anymore as well. Because people just will hit that tipping point. And this is basically how Soviet Union collapsed as well, because it basically ran out of resources to exploit. And the difference between life standards in the West and in the East was too large. And people, because of technology, were able to learn about how people live in the West. And basically collapsed under its own weight.
History would tell us, though, that that's not how the mob works. The mob basically offers you a deal, which is, I won't hurt you if you do what I say. It's not living standards that keep getting better. It's, I won't do X, Y, Z to you. Now, in the old system, that you physically had to come around and beat someone up to get them to do what you wanted. In the new system, you switch off their privileges via an algorithm, via a network. Is that, you know, is that going to collapse as well? Because that's the thing I worry about the most.
That would be very hard to get out of if we didn't have any alternative. And the alternatives are emerging. Like if you get cut off from Facebook or Twitter, you will use Signal, you will use Mastodon or Nostr. If you get cut off from the financial system, you will use Bitcoin. And these are all alternatives that came around only in the past couple of years. Like Bitcoin has been here for 14 years, Signal, I don't know how long it's been here, but it's quite recent. Everything is quite recent here. And so you have the alternative if you get cut off, and we have the power to tell the stories of people that this happened to. And I believe stories are powerful, and of course, not all the society will take care, but will take notice. But like from the individual level, you will have an alternative, which is important. Because if we, for example, have a full world of CBDC and a cashless society, that's very dystopian, definitely. But you have the ability to use Bitcoin to protect yourself against that, and that's very hard to stop.
Mm-hmm. Well, talking of Bitcoin, you wrote a great article in Bitcoin magazine about what's going on in Africa. You just went to Africa, right?
Yeah, African Bitcoin Conference in Ghana.
But I wonder if you could mention a little bit about, for people that don't know, one of the takeaways from what reading that was that Bitcoin is easily understood by many African nations because of the way that various organizations, the IMF, the World Bank, but also the CFA? The
CFA system. Yeah.
The CFA
Colonial
system.
Frank,
yeah. If you could just talk a little bit about that, what you discovered, because I think that's something like the CFA system, I think, is something that a lot of people don't even know about.
Yeah, I didn't know about it until like 18 months ago. And so, yeah, let's begin maybe with the CFA system. And everything I know about Africa and its circumstances basically comes from Alex Gladstein. So I would heavily recommend Alex Gladstein's articles on Bitcoin Magazine or his book, Check Your Financial Privilege. So the CFA system, that is a way for Western governments, mainly France, to keep a hold on their former colonies. In the Central and Western Africa, there are, I believe, 14 countries that use the CFA.
It's, which is the currency.
It's a currency.
What does it stand for?
It's in French, but
It's a currency owned by France, which is issued to these countries.
It is managed by French Ministry of Finance, yes. And it's provided to these countries. And the French government has devalued this currency, I believe, 99% over the past 70 years since it has been in use, I believe, since 50s. And one of the devaluations was in early 90s, where they basically just cut it in half, and suddenly the money was worth 50%. From day to day, it was worth 50% of its previous rate.
But so, they have complete control over the monetary policy.
Yeah, they have.
They can print it. They control, can destroy it. They can do whatever they want.
Yeah, they can. And part of the deal is also for the producers in the country, which are usually like resource producers, like miners, that they need to offer their goods. If they are selling abroad, they need to offer them to French companies first, and they have the right of first refusal. And after that, they can sell to the global market. So the French companies exploit this heavily, and they buy the raw resources and then they sell them like the value-added machines and goods back for a huge profit. The IMF and World Bank also exploits the African countries as well. This is what Alex Gladstein talked about at the conference. He beautifully explained how they were very willing to lend a lot of money to dictators in these countries. And these dictators basically bought like private jets and mansions and companies in Switzerland and financed their bank accounts in Switzerland. Then they either died or fled the country, but the debt burden stayed in the country and the citizens need to pay it back over the decades. So yeah, that's horrible.
I think it's monetary colonialism, is another way of describing it.
Yeah, that's a proper term.
You have a bunch of money that you own, that you even control. You lend it out at a high interest rate. I mean, it's a classic. It's like loan sharking on a grand scale. And when they can't pay it back, then you say, right, well, cool, give us some of your assets.
Yes, yeah, and the new tiers of credit always come along with some requirements on the country. For example, in Ghana, just before the conference, which was in December, the Ghanaian government accepted a new tier of credit facility from the World Bank, I guess, or IMF. And one of the requirements was COVID passes. Like, you need a COVID pass, a COVID like vaccination to enter the country. And that was the requirement from the IMF. So
one would assume that is a precursor to another type of pass. That does seem a bit unusual to insist on something like that. I mean, I wonder how they justified that, maybe.
Yeah. Like, one of my takeaways from the conference, talking to like Africans from various countries, was Africa is obviously like a testing place for a lot of nasty stuff, like CBDC. Nigeria is one of the first countries where they really rolled out proper CBDC, and they are starting to fight against cash. And the capital requirements in Nigeria are crazy. You cannot buy anything with your card. You cannot buy anything abroad for more than $20. Also today I've read that some entrepreneur in Senegal was buying stuff abroad, and he spent like $50, and the police came into his house and like questioned him, and it's totally horrible. And the other thing is, this is maybe a kind of a niche problem, but there's this world coin, like this eye scanning orb.
Yes.
You are aware of that?
WorldCoin. Yeah.
WorldCoin, yeah.
I didn't realize it was still going.
Yeah, nobody knows it's still going because it sort of disappeared from the discourse on Twitter and in the Western media, but it's being rolled out across, like in Kenya and in
Isn't
other African
countries.
Isn't
that the one that scans your iris to get... I mean, it's so dystopian, yes. It's horrendous.
Yeah, it is.
It's really still going?
Yeah, it is going. People from Kenya were telling me, yeah, this is happening in Kenya.
And they scan your iris to get all your kind of data, let's say.
Yeah.
And in return, you get some of their
token
that they've created out of thin air.
So, yeah, obviously...
That needs to be made... Honestly, I really thought that died a death because it was so atrocious. It was such an atrocious idea that...
So it's being tested in Africa, and a lot of stuff like that is being apparently tested in Africa. So, right, maybe like about my impressions from the conference itself.
Well, just your... Yeah, I mean, it's something we don't hear a lot about, you know, like, for example, you know, the antithesis to what... to what you've just described is what's happening in El Salvador, which is snubbing the IMF and issuing your own, you know, ways of generating income for a country. So maybe your takeaways, I mean, did you come away positive?
Yeah, very. Like the energy from the conference was something else, like something I didn't experience at other conferences. And there are like a lot of high quality conferences, but Bitcoiners in the Western world, and Czech Republic is part of that, I would say, are very like rational about Bitcoin, and maybe they can be even emotional, but they do not accept Bitcoin as much because of their experiences. Because for the Western countries, the fiat money system basically works. The payment systems work. You can get a bank account, unless you're someone like Alex Jones, of course. You can pay with cards. There are instant payments now as well. And the inflation rates weren't that high until recently. But in the African countries, most of them, there are basically no payment systems. It's mostly all based on cash. It's very hard to do any cross-border transactions because there are strong capital controls everywhere. You are not in control of your money because of the CFA system. There are no sovereign currencies like for these 14 countries. In some other countries, they have their own money, of course. And the inflation rates are something else, like 20% is quite normal for them. And there are countries that have like 50% inflation. And Zimbabwe right now is entering another hyperinflation. So my impression was, and this has been talked about quite a lot, that Africans do not need convincing that fiat money sucks, and they are naturally always looking for some alternative. It's very hard to get dollars, for example, in Nigeria or South Africa. It's hard to get euros. So you are kind of stuck with what you have, and Bitcoin is a godsend in these countries. And if you this was not just an impression from conference. We actually talked to some locals at the beach, with taxi drivers, with people in the restaurants. And if you just show them that they can download an app, receive a Bitcoin, no registrations needed, nothing required of them, and then they can buy like airtime on Bitrefill with it, it's mind-blowing for them. It's a mind-blowing experience. For us, it's quite normal because you can do that with Apple Pay or whatever. But in Africa, in Ghana, you never had any possibility to do that. And at the conference, there were a lot of builders, a lot of community organizers, developers working on really like advanced stuff, but all with this aspect of this needs to be useful right here, right now for people that have like real world problems. It's not like a toy. It's not like a speculative thing. It's something that can really connect the African countries because no one else is going to do that for them. And they need this neutral technology that is able to bypass all the controls, like the CFA system, and make their lives better. I actually talked to one guy from Somalia, which was like crazy for me to meet somebody from Somalia, which is like this totally disrupted, failed state. And he says there's a village in Somalia where he's from, and it's basically all just Bitcoin, because otherwise they wouldn't be able to buy any groceries, any pharmaceuticals, and they survive just because he knows about Bitcoin, and he's able to travel to some city and buy some stuff with Bitcoin and just drive it back to the village.
Really? Has that ever been reported? I've never heard that story.
No, it hasn't.
But, you met a dude in and there's a village in Somalia where the people are using Bitcoin because that's all they can use.
Yeah, and there were so many stories like that at the conference.
God, I'm going to have to dig deeper in that one. That's fascinating. Hey, I'm cognizant of time here. I know you've got to go, but we've got a bit longer.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, you're talking about Bitcoin in the context of Africa there, and a certain emerging nations and et cetera, et cetera. I was interested to know what your opinion on what you know of the Free Cities movement and why it's evolving, why it's here, what it represents. What's your impression of whether or not Bitcoin is necessary or not?
Right. So to be honest, I don't know that much. I know of like attempts from the past of like creating these libertarian communities. There was this gold gulch in Chile, I believe, that failed. So
I mean, you were being pretty descriptive earlier, talking about privately owned places where you right. sign a contract to join.
Yeah.
And that contract is in perpetuity. So those kind of systems.
Yeah. So, yeah, that sounds amazing. But also depends on how the law is enforceable or the contracts are enforceable, because still we live under this system where the state has this monopoly on the judicial system and law enforcement. So that's the weak spot.
It is the weak spot, which is why I asked you about Bitcoin, because arguably you could posit that Bitcoin disenfranchises the state, therefore...
It does in the long term, in
yes.
the long run, but the problem with... I have even a problem with like Bitcoin citadels, as they are. It's some similar concept to private cities, I think. The land always is in some like state jurisdiction, and it's just the nature of state that it has a full monopoly on violence and on enforcing the law of the land in the region. So in the short term, I'm kind of skeptical of us being able to build these communities, and I'm more in favor of, instead of like seclusion of libertarians and Bitcoiners, just being part of the society and trying to, like, either through rational means, like explaining, orange-pilling people, getting them on board, or through like incentives, building good businesses, building good applications and tools to just get on board the rest of the society. Because if we seclude ourselves, that's never a good look, I would say, from the majority of the society. There have been many attempts like that, but maybe I misunderstand the concept. I think it's a great concept for the long run, when the state is sufficiently weak, or maybe it is possible now in some other parts of the planet. I don't think, like in Czech Republic, you could build a private city.
The seasteaders would probably mm-hmm. have an issue with you. You know what seasteaders
yeah,
are?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
They would say, well, we have a jurisdiction that doesn't belong to anyone. So
yeah, hopefully.
I mean, not that I necessarily think the seasteading's any better or worse than anything else, but you're bullish in the long run.
Yes.
And in the short run? Your how do you see the best path forward? If you were talking to someone who had a belief in the free city model, what would they be advised to do in the short term?
My advice would be to not to try to build a city or a community previously empty space. Like just start with where you are, and if you are, like, I think it's much better to try to change like your surroundings. You don't have to change the whole nation. It's good to start with maybe your local shop with your neighbors. And I know that's hard because I've been part of the housing committee for the 10 years and. It's just a nightmare. So,
correct.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, yeah, maybe one example is if you're living in a city and you know about other like people that have similar leanings to you, like libertarian Bitcoiners, let's say, maybe a good idea to buy a house together or just move together in one building gradually, like 10 flats, and try to get like libertarians in. Maybe if you are a like OG Bitcoiner and you have sufficient money, maybe buy the building and try to have like tenants that are philosophically close to you, and keep the building like the best maintained in the street and lead by example, but do it in your current community. I think that's there's basically nothing to criticize against about that. But if you build like your own village where you homeschool your children, you are vocal against like vaccinations and drink raw milk and stuff like that, people will just point fingers at you and say you are some crazy potential terrorist or something.
That's good practical advice, I'd imagine. It's funny that it's come up in conversation three times today, talking to three different people, was that we're living in an age where digital relationships are manifesting physically, mm-hmm. and it's all a lot. It's really accelerated since lockdowns, when everyone went online and realized that their ideologically aligned brothers and sisters were out there somewhere. And it's been a couple of years now, and you know, it seems to be manifesting more and more. But I like your take. It's true. There's two ways to do this. One is to transform from the inside, and the other one, which I have to say a lot, just as many people believe, is to say, okay, look, I'm sick of trying to save this from within. I'm just going to ignore that and go and do something else, which I would argue is the Bitcoin way almost. I mean, Satoshi didn't try and campaign to change monetary policy. Mm-hmm. He created a new thing, and you can ignore the old monetary policy now. Right. So would am I barking up the wrong tree there? Is there any truth in that?
Well, yeah, it's a parallel system. You don't need to go against the current system as such. You basically just do your own thing, and it works for you. It works for your friends, family. It works for people in developing nations for whom the system never really worked. And you basically no longer care about what goes on in the central banks, in the IMF, and yeah, they are criticizing it all the time, but they cannot stop it. So it brings a huge peace of mind and a huge optimistic towards the future. And yeah, you can see that quality in Bitcoiners, that they are usually quite family oriented and take more care about themselves, have this slow time preference, because you don't need to forcefully change anything. It's a peaceful revolution.
And slowly the old system disappears into irrelevance.
Hopefully, yeah. I believe it boils down to economics again. In the long run, the good money will drive out the bad one, because the bad money will basically hyperinflate to do nothing, and people will naturally look for alternatives, and it has nothing to do with understanding economics or political philosophy. People just tend to look for alternatives if the current thing no longer works for them, which is increasingly what fiat is becoming. It's becoming useless in terms of long-term savings, and in some way also in terms of medium of exchange, because of more and more restrictions coming in all the time, and it's getting politicized with sanctions, with the Freedom Convoy, ostracization from the system, and this is not getting any better. So in the long run, I'm very optimistic about freedom taking over, because it basically boils down to economic incentives. And I believe economic laws are as strong as natural laws, and they will prevail in the long run. You can suppress them for some time, but they will bounce back even stronger then.
Hallelujah to that. Last question, because and we ask everyone that comes on this podcast, you have a 1-year sabbatical in which you can do whatever you want. It's all paid for. You have money at your fingertips. What do you do in your 1 year? It even has longevity. If you were to take that money and build a hotel, the hotel would still be there when the year was up. What would you do?
Right. Yeah, that would be very exciting. I would travel quite a lot with my family, probably. and I would probably sit down and write another book. I'm just finishing my third book now. So, but there's always things to think about and write down.
What's your book called? Or if it doesn't have a name, what's it about?
Yeah, it doesn't have a name. It's in Czech, but in English it would be called The Return of Sound Money. And obviously it's about Bitcoin.
Great. Well, thanks for talking to us. That was very highly informative, good luck with the new book. And I haven't read your old books, but I love the titles of your books.
One of the books will be published in English, hopefully, this year.
Okay. I was going to say, it's not possible. And thanks for the socks as well.
Yeah, I
got some new Honey Badger socks.
Honey Badger socks.
Is that how? Did you say that you have a company that makes socks?
Well, I have my own line of merch because I do my podcast and all kinds of Bitcoin education. So I have my own merch. I print my own T-shirts and do socks and
great.
Stuff like
I'd try and push new listeners to your podcast, but we won't be able to understand it.
You can check out my articles on Bitcoin Magazine.
Yeah. Well, Joseph, thank you very much for speaking, and hopefully we'll see you again another time.
Thank you.